and an enormous Persian rug covered the floor.
"Are the books fake?" Liz asked. "No offense."
"They have pages with words on them, if that's what you're asking. But yes, I'm sure that even when they were first acquired, they were a bit of an affectation. I once read a copy of Treasure Island I found in here, but we mostly lived upstairs. The whole first floor, as you can see, has a public feel to it, and my mother was very civically involved. She and my father hosted lots of fundraising events."
"It's like the White House," Charlotte said, and Darcy said,
"In a way, I suppose."
From the library, they proceeded through the reception room, which was a sort of mini-living room, the drawing room, which was another sort of mini-living room, this one apparently intended for women to retire to when the men enjoyed their post-dinner cigars and brandy, then the dining room, the butler's pantry, and the kitchen. In the reception room, Darcy had gestured at the doorway, which was framed by columns and a peaked roof, and said to Liz,
"All that trim is known as an edicule. That's a good word for a writer, huh?"
Who was this man? This gracious and genial host sharing his time, demonstrating impeccable manners in a context in which he'd have been justified showing the opposite? And how strange it was that he'd grown up in this ludicrous house. Truly, it seemed more like the set of a television show about opulence than a home. The black marble stairwell they ascended was near the trophy room. From the landing, an orchard was visible. On the second floor, the bedrooms all included fireplaces, and most featured televisions from before the flat-screen era. A poster of Larry Bird still hung on the wall of the room that had been Darcy's, and a CD player with a slot for a cassette tape rested on the small desk. There was, to Liz, something unexpectedly poignant about these items, as well as about the navy blue comforter smoothed over the bed. How many years had elapsed since he'd slept in it? And the framed photo of his soccer team in perhaps fourth or fifth grade? But doubt overtook her, and she wondered if her surge of tenderness toward Darcy was gold-digging in disguise. She didn't consciously yearn to be the mistress of a place like Pemberley, but the wealth it implied was astonishing indeed. Darcy led them back downstairs and outside. Behind the house, in a fruit and vegetable garden off the kitchen, they sampled one small ripe tomato each, before proceeding through a walled garden, then a sunken garden, then a rose garden, and finally a descending series of terraces, on the lowest of which a reflecting pool shimmered in the mid-afternoon sun. This wasn't the swimming pool, Darcy explained, though he led them there next. The swimming pool had been added in the 1940s. And adjacent to it was the guest house where Darcy told them he and some of his visitors would sleep during the weekend. As the tour wound down, Liz wished to say something that conveyed her appreciation for his kindness while leading it. A kindness all the more remarkable in light of their last interaction in Cincinnati. What she said, as the three of them approached Charlotte's car without re-entering the main house, was, "Thanks for showing us around." Darcy looked at her, and she looked at him. And if not for Charlotte, Liz wondered what sentiments either of them might express.
"Of course," he said. "It's funny, both of us being out here this weekend."
He stepped forward and kissed Charlotte's cheek.
"My knowledge of the area is dated, but if you need any pointers, be in touch."
"Will do," Charlotte said.
"Goodbye, Liz,"
Darcy said. And when he leaned in to kiss her cheek, she resisted the impulse to cling to him. In an instant, the kiss was finished. What was there to do but climb into Charlotte's car? Liz did so, and as Charlotte started the engine, Liz felt she might cry. On the other side of the window, Darcy's expression was pensive. As the car pulled away,
Liz gave him a small and miserable wave.
Okay, that was nuts, Charlotte said. That was totally, completely...
Wait, he's saying something. Stop! In her side-view mirror, Liz could see Darcy jogging after them from 20 feet back. Charlotte braked, and Liz opened her window.
I don't know why I didn't think of this earlier,
Darcy said, and he was only the slightest bit breathless.
You two should come here for dinner tonight. And Willie, too, obviously. Given what a fan of yours my sister is, Liz, she'd be thrilled to meet you.
Oh! Liz turned to Charlotte, then turned back to Darcy. We're supposed to have dinner with my aunt and uncle, Willie's parents. I mean, thank you, but...
Bring them along. How does 6:30 sound?
6:30 is great, Charlotte said.
Any food restrictions for either of you?
Darcy asked.
Georgie doesn't eat meat, so we'll have vegetarian options.
No restrictions for me, Liz said, and Charlotte said.
Me either. What can we bring?
Just yourselves, Darcy said.
I'll grill something simple. Liz, if you tell me your number, I'll text you now, and when you get here tonight, you can text me to open the front gate.
She recited the digits, and seconds later, her phone buzzed in her pocket. After all this time, she had Darcy's cell phone number. She had Darcy's number, and he had hers. And she felt as giddy as if the cutest boy in seventh grade had slipped the note into her locker.
I'm glad this will work, Darcy said.
In a purring tone that made Liz want to slap her friend, Charlotte said, Darcy, the pleasure is ours. Chapter 121. Such were Liz's nerves that when she and Charlotte stopped to buy wine to take to Pemberley that evening, Liz purchased an additional bottle of Merlot, which she opened as soon as possible in Charlotte's kitchen. It is after 5 in Cincinnati, Liz said, and New York.
Hey, Charlotte said, go for it.
Do you really think he wants to make dinner for a bunch of people, including my aunt and uncle, whom he's never met, when he has all those guests arriving tomorrow? Charlotte grinned. That man is completely in love with you, she said.
I'm sure he'd like nothing better.
Liz took a long swallow from the glass she'd poured. Join me?
Twist my arm,
Charlotte said, and Liz poured a second glass. The one advantage of the new dinner plan, Liz thought, was that her complicated feelings about spending the evening with Darcy so overshadowed her complicated feelings about seeing Cousin Willie as to make the latter set of emotions negligible. Her rejection of Willie was no longer the one that preoccupied her. Liz and Charlotte carried their wine glasses to the front porch of the modest 3-bedroom ranch house that Liz knew, because she'd checked online, had cost Willie $1.1 million in 2010. As they sat on Adirondack chairs, the afternoon sky was cerulean with a smattering of cumulus clouds. Palo Alto seemed, in this moment, an unaffordable yet truly delightful place to live. The problem with your theory of Darcy still being into me, Liz said, is that he invited Caroline up for the weekend. And not even with her brother. Just by herself.
Caroline is odious. There's no way she can compete with you.
Well, they were involved in the past. They've definitely slept together.
And that distinguishes Caroline from you how?
Charlotte was leering. Did you ever notice in Cincinnati that she was all over him? It's obvious she wants to get back together. Liz felt too jittery to remain seated, and she stood. Is it okay if I take a shower?
Of course. The towels are on the bed.
Before entering the house, Liz said, Sorry for letting this stuff with Darcy hijack my visit. After we get through dinner, we'll hatch a plan for your life here.
Lizzie, nothing could bring me greater happiness than to have you staying at my house, freaking out about a boy.
Chapter 122. They caravaned back to Pemberley, Willie and Charlotte in his Prius, Liz riding with Aunt Margot and Uncle Frank. Willie had greeted Liz by saying in an accusatory tone,
"Obviously, a lot has changed since I last saw you."
And Liz had replied, with a sincerity that took her by surprise, "I'm so happy for you and Charlotte." As she rode from Palo Alto to Atherton, Liz offered Aunt Margot updates from Cincinnati. Mr. Bennett's health, Jane's breakup with Chip, Liz provided much less detail than she'd given earlier to Charlotte, Lydia's new beau. Conveniently, describing him was helpful in avoiding discussion of the house in which Aunt Margot had grown up being for sale. Shortly, Uncle Frank was turning onto Pemberley Lane. Reaching the gates of the estate, he whistled in appreciation.
"This must be some friend you've made, Lizzie."
"Hi, it's Liz," Liz texted Darcy. "We're here." A few seconds later, the gates opened. In front of the main house, Liz spotted Darcy and a slender young woman who tucked her straight light brown hair behind her ears and kept her head slightly ducked, as if avoiding the glare of the sunset, though the house faced north. When the cars were parked and their occupants discharged, all seven of them stood in the gravel driveway while introductions were made and handshakes exchanged. Darcy wore high-quality flip-flops, khaki pants, and a white Oxford cloth shirt rolled up to the elbows, and plain, save for a monogram on the left breast pocket. FCDV, it said. And Liz knew from looking online that his middle name was Cornelius. It was immediately obvious to Liz that Georgie was anorexic. More than a decade in the employ of a women's magazine had given her an abundance of experience discerning eating disorders, and made her both sympathetic to their challenges and wary of focusing inordinate attention on them. Indeed, before the end of her first year at Mascara, she'd privately vowed to cease all conversation about food or exercise with her co-workers, lest she become as obsessive as some of them. She had, of course, broken the vow many times, but she still credited it with helping her retain perspective. A few inches shorter than Liz, Georgie couldn't have topped 100 pounds, and though she wore a loose linen shirt along with jeans and flats, the line of her jaw and the prominence of her teeth were clues to her extreme thinness. She seemed far more fragile than Liz had anticipated. Kitty and Lydia were downright husky by comparison.
"We'll eat at the guest house."
Looking among Uncle Frank, Aunt Margot, and Willie, Darcy added,
"I've already subjected Liz and Charlotte to a tour of the main house today, so I'm inclined to spare the rest of you."
Aunt Margot, Liz observed, met this news with disappointment that she quickly concealed, though neither Willie nor Uncle Frank seemed to care. As they all walked past the east wing of the house, Darcy said,
"You'll see that the pool is next to the guest house, but I have to apologize for not offering you the chance to swim. We haven't opened it in a few years."
Uncle Frank snapped his fingers, as if let down.
"And here I'd stashed a Speedo in my glove compartment just in case."
Everyone chuckled politely at this appetite-spoiling image, and Liz found herself falling into step beside Georgie. "Thank you for having us over on such short notice," Liz said. "I hope you weren't alarmed when your brother said 5 strangers would be joining you for dinner."
"Oh, the opposite," Georgie said. "Fitzy's talked about you so much, and I think he told you I'm a big mascara reader."
Quickly, Georgie added, at the risk of sounding like a dorky fangirl.
"Ah, but I love dorky fangirls," Liz said.
"So Darcy, or I guess you just called him Fitzy, he said you're a graduate student?"
Georgie nodded.
"I'm in the middle of my dissertation, which will probably be read by about 8 people total, if I ever manage to finish it. I have to ask you this, even though I'm sure everyone does. Do you think Hudson Blaze cheated on Gillian Northcutt? Forsaking her usual guardedness on the topic, Liz said, Of course he did. Have you ever interviewed him? Georgie asked. Liz shook her head. Although the word on the street is that he's not big on bathing and smells kind of funky. Georgie giggled. Was Gillian nice? She was nice enough. I think it was such a weird time in her life, and obviously she was talking about the breakup not because she wanted to, but because she had a movie to promote. I felt bad for her, actually. What's your dissertation about? Early 20th century French suffragettes and taxation. Fascinating, huh?
Georgie, have you seen the corkscrew?
Darcy called from a few yards ahead. They had reached the guest house, and he stood by a two-tiered cart that held an array of wine bottles, glasses, and napkins. Georgie pointed. On the lower level. The pool was covered by a vast green tarp that somehow didn't compromise the loveliness of the setting. Four matching chaise longues were lined up alongside the pool, and a lushly cushioned couch and chairs sat near the entrance to the guest house. On either side of the couch, heat lamps stood sentinel. Two additional heat lamps flanked a long iron table set with green plates and matching green cloth napkins, all so elegantly arranged that Liz had a hunch that someone other than Darcy or Georgie, someone with professional expertise, had organized the display. Beyond the far end of the pool lay a lawn of the most deeply green and perfectly manicured grass Liz had ever seen. The expanse begged to be used, and Liz wished she knew how to do backflips, or even just a decent cartwheel. A scent that Liz thought of as distinctly Californian, perhaps it was eucalyptus, became perceptible. Cousin Willie approached Liz and Georgie with two glasses of red wine and said,
Ladies?
Liz took hers, but Georgie shook her head. I'll just have water. When everyone had a drink, Darcy held up his glass.
To family and friends.
Liz's eyes met his briefly, and then they were clinking glasses, as was everyone else.
It was difficult to know how to manage her energy. How to manage herself in the company of this version of Darcy. She could see, with a sudden and not entirely welcome clarity, that in Cincinnati, she had cultivated her own rancor toward him. She had made rude and provocative remarks, had searched for offense in his responses, and had relished the slights that may or may not have been delivered. Yet, in spite of the culminating acrimony during his confession, he had decided to set aside their ill will. His present behavior wasn't a sarcastic impersonation of good manners. It wasn't meant to count technically as kindness without containing true warmth. It simply was kindness. He treated his guests, her included, as if he couldn't imagine a greater pleasure than spending the evening with them. And in doing so, he exacerbated Liz's shame about her past pettiness toward him. At some point during the larger group conversation, when neither of them was interacting with anyone else, Liz turned to Darcy.
When do your other guests get here?
Anywhere from late morning tomorrow to early afternoon. You're welcome to come back if you'd like. I'm sure Caroline would enjoy seeing you.
Liz scrutinized Darcy's face and finally said, Do you not realize that Caroline Bingley and I can't stand each other?
Darcy looked amused. Since when?
Since about 30 seconds after we met. I suppose it's possible I don't register with her enough for her to dislike me, but I don't like her.
Do I dare ask why?
The reason not to criticize Caroline wasn't that she didn't deserve criticism, Liz thought. It was that criticizing her would only make Liz look bad. She said, If I tell you, you'll think I'm a person who pretends that gossiping shows my anthropological interest in the human condition. Darcy winced a little, and Liz added,
too soon?
No sooner than I deserve. If you'll excuse me, I should start grilling.
Had she in fact offended him? He headed inside the guest house and emerged a moment later carrying one platter of raw steaks and another of portobello mushrooms and zucchini cut into long strips.
Uncle Frank joined him at the grill, and Liz could hear her uncle strike up a conversation about the history of the estate.
It's no secret that property in Atherton is worth a pretty penny,
Uncle Frank said, and Darcy said affably,
Yes, times have changed since my great-great-grandfather bought this land for $12 an acre.
Liz rose, looking for a bathroom. On the other side of the guest house's glass door, she found herself inside a great room with stainless steel kitchen appliances lining one wall. Passing a first bathroom, she walked down a hall by three bedrooms. Two held twin beds and one contained an unmade king-sized bed, with an open suitcase on the floor beside it, and beyond the suitcase, an interior bathroom. As she washed her hands afterward in a sink with a pattern of blue peonies painted across the basin and faucet handles, she was struck, as she occasionally was during a third glass of wine, by how cute she looked in the mirror. Sober, she tended, like most women she knew, towards self-criticism. But tipsy, she could admire her own brightly inquisitive eyes, her shiny hair and game smile, as well as the flattering cut of her jeans and the boost offered by the overpriced bra she'd purchased that afternoon. Even in the presence of her weird cousin and corny uncle, the night had taken on a certain enchanted quality that arose from the splendor of the setting, from the crisp air, the candles they relied on as twilight gathered, and above all, from Darcy's solicitousness, which she felt to be directed primarily at her. Indeed, she interpreted his attention to all the guests as a personal tribute. But of course, she was not certain. She was certain of nothing. Whether by her own angling or a more mutual stratagem, Liz ended up next to Darcy for dinner. Her aunt was on his other side. Complimenting the meat and vegetables Darcy had grilled were a loaf of fresh bread, a salad, and more wine. All of them outstanding, though what food and drink wouldn't have tasted delicious beneath a starry sky on a late summer evening? "Was your mother a native Californian like your father?" Aunt Margot asked Darcy, and he shook his head. "She was a proud Yankee who could never quite believe she'd settled here permanently." Darcy looked at his sister. "Wouldn't you say, Georgie?" The focus of the table shifting to her seemed to make Georgie self-conscious, but she sounded composed as she said, "Our mom grew up in Boston, and she'd lose her voice yelling at the TV during Red Sox games."
"How did your parents meet?"
Liz asked.
Darcy said, "Mom was an undergraduate at Radcliffe when our dad was in medical school. She was only 19 when Dad proposed, and he assumed she'd drop out of school and move here with him. She refused. He joined a practice in San Francisco, but supposedly he kept proposing to her once a month, writing letters. She finally said yes the day after her graduation."
"Your father was a doctor, too," Aunt Margot said.
"A general practitioner," Darcy said. "I think in another life our mom would have been a landscape architect. When I picture her, it's digging in the gardens here."
"I just realized," Georgie said, "you should all come to our croquet tournament tomorrow."
A silence ensued, and Georgie added, "You don't need to wear white or anything. It's informal."
"They probably have plans, Georgie," Darcy said. "Liz, how long are you in town?"
"Till Sunday night."
"I bet we can make it work," Charlotte said. "Don't you think, Liz? What time does the tournament start?"
"Around 3, Georgie said. "I mean, don't feel obligated if it sounds boring."
"Margot and I will take a rain check,"
Uncle Frank said.
We'll be enjoying some R&R on a friend's boat. And I need to be at the office, Willie said. We're in crunch time, and I'm lucky to have gotten away for dinner.
Then definitely count Liz and me in, Charlotte said. Darcy, I trust you remember from charades that Liz is a fierce competitor.
I remember it well, Darcy said.
Chapter 123. A 60-something woman named Alberta materialized before dessert to ask if they needed anything, and Darcy complimented her on the excellence of the food, thereby confirming Liz's impression that he had done little to prepare it. However, it was Darcy himself who loaded the dishwasher, as Liz, Charlotte, and Georgie carried plates into the guest house. Georgie had just taken a hazelnut tort outside. Liz doubted the young woman would be eating any, and Charlotte followed with a pint of vanilla ice cream, leaving Darcy and Liz inside and truly alone together for the first time that evening. As Darcy scrubbed the salad bowl, Liz, who was no more than 5 feet away, said,
"Thank you,"
and he turned off the water.
"Thank you for everything tonight," she began again, and talking over her, he said,
"You don't have to come tomorrow just to humor Georgie. Now that I know how you feel about Caroline Bingley, I..."
"No, it's fine."
This time, it was her interrupting him. "I mean, I don't want to impose if..."
"You're more than welcome to join us."
Then they just stood there, looking at each other. She wished that kissing him was not impossible. Was kissing him impossible? Surely so, with his sister and her aunt and uncle and cousin and friend on the other side of the glass door. It then seemed that maybe they were going to kiss after all, in spite of the lack of privacy and the confused circumstances, because he stepped toward her and she stepped toward him. He said,
"Since you left Cincinnati..."
At that moment, Georgie walked in and said, "Did Alberta leave the serving knife in the main house?"
"Oh, sorry."
"It's right here."
Darcy turned, opened a drawer, and handed the knife to Georgie. Both the eye contact and the spell had been broken. And yet Georgie's apology, it was proof to Liz that a spell had existed. She wasn't just imagining it. She said to Georgie,
"I've got the dessert plates."
Because Liz didn't wish to increase Georgie's discomfort, also because Liz didn't know what else to do, she followed the other woman out to the patio. A moment later, Darcy emerged after them. It was Aunt Margot who cut the tort.
"Since I left Cincinnati, what?" Liz thought.
Though she wasn't alone again with Darcy before they departed, her heart had swollen during that encounter in the kitchen, and it did not shrink again until some hours after she had climbed into the guest bed at Willie and Charlotte's house. Chapter 124. In Charlotte's car on El Camino Real, returning to Pemberley the following afternoon, Liz pulled down the sun visor and looked at herself in the mirror, which was something she'd already spent a not inconsiderable amount of time doing at Charlotte and Willie's house, where she'd carefully applied foundation, mascara, and lipstick. In the car, she said,
"Is it weird we're going?"
"Liz, the ST between you and Darcy is threatening to engulf Northern California in a fiery ball. It's your duty to save us all by having sex."
"I'm glad this is providing you with so much entertainment."
Liz pulled her lipstick from her purse, applied a fresh coat. One of the many tips she had learned during her years at mascara was to begin at the center of her lips and move toward the corners, then rubbed her lips together.
"For real, though, I hope Caroline doesn't think we crashed the party."
"Who cares what Caroline thinks?"
Liz slid the cover across the sun visor mirror and folded the visor back into place.
"True. Did you wear earplugs again last night?"
"It was like an angel rocked me to sleep,"
Thank you for suggesting it.
Charlotte turned off El Camino Real and said in a more serious tone, I know Willie isn't dashing like Darcy, but I think he loves me, and I want to make it work.
I'm sure he loves you.
It's weird, Charlotte said, because if your dad hadn't had a heart attack, you and Jane wouldn't have come back to Cincinnati this summer, and if you hadn't come back to Cincinnati, Willie wouldn't have visited with Margot, and I'd never have met him. Sometimes it amazes me how much these defining parts of our lives hinge on chance.
I know. I think about that all the time.
They both were quiet, and the fence of Pemberley came into view.
Are you on the pill?
Charlotte asked. Because we can turn around and go buy a condom.
That won't be necessary, Liz said.
Chapter 125. What a coincidence that you happen to be in town the same weekend Darcy is here, Caroline said to Liz by way of greeting. They stood on the lawn near the covered pool, where the croquet equipment had already been set out. The wickets inserted into the grass, the mallets and balls waiting in tidy rows. Along one side of the pool, a buffet lunch still looked vibrant, despite the fact that it was mid-afternoon. Various sandwiches and salads, enormous cookies, lemonade, iced tea, beer, and white wine. Surveying the scene, Liz had the somewhat troubling thought that she was starting to understand Darcy's unfavorable view of Cincinnati. It would be difficult for any place to compete with these lush gardens, blue skies, and magnificent spreads of food.
I'm visiting Charlotte, Liz said to Caroline. You may have heard that she's dating my cousin Willie.
I guess beauty really is in the eye of the beholder, Caroline said. Liz was fairly sure Charlotte didn't overhear the insult, because she was being introduced to the half-dozen other guests, but the remark seemed too rude to simply let stand.
Is it my cousin or my oldest friend that you're implying is ugly?
Liz asked. Caroline shrugged. Take your pick. When two people like that get together, I never know if I should be happy for them or just pray they don't reproduce.
You're awful, Liz thought. You're even worse than I remember.
Speaking of which, Caroline said, has Jane reached the swollen ankles and stretch marks stage yet?
Liz smiled as warmly as she could manage. You know how some pregnant women just give off a glow the whole time? Jane's been blessed.
Before Caroline could respond, Liz added,
I hear Chip's still shooting the eligible reunion. Is Holly the alligator wrestler part of it? Or it's Gabrielle who has the Celtic cross tattoo on her tongue, right? It always seemed like she and Chip had a lot of chemistry.
Liz beamed at Caroline.
Either one would be so fun for you to have as a sister-in-law.
Chapter 126. Upon their arrival, Charlotte and Liz had been welcomed by Darcy in a gracious but not especially fraught way. Liz was almost disappointed by how not fraught, and introduced to the other guests, all of whose names Liz promptly forgot, an anesthesiologist and his lawyer wife, a seemingly single male radiologist, a nephrologist, male, married to an architect, also male, plus two Stanford history PhDs. Both slender young men whom Liz suspected, based on their posture and inflections around Darcy's sister, to be in love with Georgie. Though Liz's initial interactions with Darcy were subdued and matter-of-fact, as the afternoon progressed and the croquet began, they were playing two separate games simultaneously, both of them the so-called cutthroat version, in which it was everyone for him or herself rather than teams. Liz felt there to be an ever-increasing charge between herself and her host. She was at all times acutely conscious of how far he stood from her, of his absence if he stepped away, to bring out additional bottles of wine from the guest house, say, or to greet the final arrival, a dermatologist, at the front gate, and whom he was talking with. Periodically, it was she who was speaking to him, always in an undramatic fashion. They weren't playing in the same game, but the two courts had been set up on adjacent stretches of grass, and they were sometimes near each other. They'd comment on a shot someone had taken, or on the pleasantness of the weather. And while such topics felt faintly ridiculous, so presumably would anything else. When Liz knocked her ball out of bounds, Darcy materialized as she was placing it the prescribed distance from the boundary. "I always have this fantasy of discovering some new skill," she said, "but apparently it's not croquet."
Darcy squinted. "Are you wearing makeup?"
Instinctively, Liz brought a hand to one cheek. "Does it look weird?"
"I guess I'm not used to you in it," Darcy said,
and more defensively than she meant to, Liz said, "It is something women often put on their faces." Without speaking, Darcy patted her right shoulder, as if comforting her. Instead, the contact was unsettling, but in a good way. Eventually, Alberta drove up in a golf cart to clear away the used plates and utensils. Liz had, by that point, consumed 2.5 glasses of wine, 3 bites of a turkey sandwich, and half a cookie. She was too nervous to eat more. It was Darcy who'd won the first game, and Charlotte the second. Caroline said to Liz, "I take it you're not much of an athlete." Though Liz had mocked her own croquet skills with Darcy, she couldn't permit such a slight from Caroline. "Well, I run 25 miles a week," she said, "and for my job, I've tried pretty much every fitness trend out there, but I suppose I'm not athletic besides that." The two women looked at each other with barely disguised antipathy, and Caroline said, "You leave town tomorrow, right? Is my presence thwarting plans that you had?" Caroline took a step closer to Liz and lowered her voice. "Just so you know, I see right through you. Your whole laid-back vibe, I can tell it's bullshit."
"Coming from you, I think that might be a compliment."
As Liz finished her third glass of wine, impatience, regret, and tipsiness collected within her. Oh, to get a do-over for that brawless, unprepared morning at her sister's apartment. To be granted just one more run up Madison Road with Darcy. Only the two of them and no one else. And then to decamp for his apartment, this time with the awareness that he didn't see the encounter as purely transactional. To know that he liked her. But did he still like her? Here? Today? How long did the sex hormones to which he'd attributed his love linger in the bloodstream? A short while later, Liz heard herself telling Georgie, as one of Georgie's suitors listened in, "Your brother mentioned that you guys might sell or donate this property at some point, and I hope this isn't too forward, but I want to tell you about something my older sister did. My parents are selling the house they've lived in for a long time, so my sister, who's a yoga instructor, held, like, a ritual farewell, where she talked about some of the things we'd done at the house and what she'd miss. And even though I was skeptical, I think it's helped me. Oh, and it only took 5 minutes." Georgie looked both interested and confused. She said, "Did someone come and do it for you, or did she do it herself?" "No. She did it. I could ask if she was following a script or just winging it."
"If you want to learn about moving superstitions, you should talk to my Chinese grandma,"
Georgie's suitor said. He was still talking when suddenly Darcy was beside Liz. He touched her arm just above the elbow, and again, she felt she might swoon. Instead, in an impossibly normal voice, she said, "Hi." As Georgie and her suitor continued their conversation, Darcy said,
"I wonder if you're free to get breakfast tomorrow."
"Oh," Liz said, "sure."
It would have to be early, because there's a group hike planned. Of course, you and Charlotte are welcome to join that, too.
Aware that her friend would probably contradict the statement, Liz said, I need to give Charlotte some undivided attention, since she's the reason I'm in California, but breakfast sounds great.
Is 8 a.m. uncivilized?
It's perfect.
If you text me Charlotte's address, I'll pick you up.
So he felt it, too. Or he felt at least something. He wanted to be alone with her, even if, judging from his calmness, he didn't want it as much as she wanted to be alone with him. She yearned to fling her body against his, to smash her face into his shirt, kiss his neck and face, and take him away to where she didn't have to share him. Blandly, she said, Charlotte and Willie live in Palo Alto. Their house is really close to here.
Chapter 127.
My brother, Georgie whispered, and she gripped Liz's wrist. It was dusk, and Liz and Charlotte would be leaving momentarily, though Charlotte and the nephrologist were caught up in a heated discussion about earthquakes. I think he likes you, Georgie continued, still whispering. Liz's buzz had worn off, but she wondered if the other woman was drunk. If so, Liz was surprised, given the caloric content of alcohol. Seriously, Georgie said, and it's perfect, because I've always been scared he'll end up with Caroline Bingley, and she sucks. Yes, Georgie was definitely drunk, which did not mean she wasn't to be trusted. In the fading light, Liz regarded the younger woman. For what it's worth, I agree with you, she said. Caroline does suck. Do you like Fitzy? Liz hesitated only briefly. Yes, she said, I do. As in, like him? Liz smiled. I knew what you meant, and the answer is still yes. Georgie pulled her phone from her pocket. Give me your number, and next time I'm in New York, you and Jillian Northcutt and I should have coffee. Here. Liz reached for the phone and typed the numbers in herself. She wondered if Georgie would recall their conversation in the morning, and if she did, whether she'd repeat it to her brother. Passing back the phone, Liz said, I can't speak for Jillian Northcutt, but I'd be delighted to see you any time.
Chapter 128.
He picked her up on time in a gray SUV with California license plates. The morning was sunny again, but still cool, and Liz had slept even less the previous night than the night before that. Around 4 a.m., she had decided there was nothing to do but ask him for another chance. As geographically inconvenient and temperamentally implausible as a relationship between them seemed, she wanted it. She wanted it desperately. And she needed to know if he did, too. Riding to the restaurant he'd selected, the Palo Alto Creamery, though the food was, of course, irrelevant, she felt them inhabiting some simulacrum of coupledom that was both torturous and enticing. His right hand resting on the gear shift near her left knee, his forearm with its brown hair, the almost imperceptible scent of whatever male shampoo or soap or aftershave he used. She could barely stand it. His handsomeness this early in the day was devastating and unmanageable. And so she reverted to small talk. She inquired whether everyone else in the house had been asleep when he'd left, and Darcy confirmed that they had. She asked if a late night had ensued after her and Charlotte's departure, and he again answered in the affirmative. She noted that he must be exhausted, and he said he was accustomed to sleep deprivation. Turning onto Emerson Street, Darcy said,
Georgie thinks you're great.
Oh, it's mutual, Liz said. She's charming.
I wish you and my mom could have met. You would have gotten a kick out of each other.
Liz's heart squeezed. I wish I could have met her, too. She sounds very cool.
Darcy glanced across the front seat.
Seeing Georgie, did she look different from how you pictured? Or maybe you didn't picture her a particular way.
A certain giddiness drained out of Liz, which was okay. Giddiness was, after all, difficult to sustain. Carefully, she said, "She's very thin, obviously. Is that what you mean?"
"She's been in and out of different treatment centers, which, as far as I can tell, do nothing."
Darcy sighed.
"But I still wonder if she should go back. She's lost weight again since I last saw her."
"I have a colleague who did a program in North Carolina that really seemed to help. I think it Duke. Has Georgie ever tried that one?"
"Duke doesn't sound familiar. She's been to places in Southern California and Arizona."
Darcy smiled sadly.
"The one outside San Diego. I think the reason she agreed to check in was that a bunch of celebrities have been patients there, but her stint was celebrity-free. It must have been the off-season."
"I know eating disorders are really hard," Liz said. "I'm sorry."
"I worry that her life is on hold," Darcy said. "And I worry about her heart and kidneys."
He was pulling into a parking space. How inevitable things seemed. How close to him Liz felt when her phone buzzed with an incoming text. If not for her father's heart attack, she might not have looked at the phone. She might simply have gone into the restaurant and ordered scrambled eggs that she would barely have eaten. Instead, she did look. Before she read the message, she saw the name of the text sender, and she said, "Speaking of sisters, this is from Mary." Then she said, "Oh my God."
"Is everything all right?" Darcy asked.
But for the first time in 2 days, Darcy was not foremost in her mind. Something else had abruptly pushed him aside, and his voice was background noise. "Lydia and Ham eloped to Chicago," Mary's text read. "Turns out Ham transgender/born female. M&D freaking out. Can you come home?" Chapter 129.
"Is everything all right?"
Darcy asked again. "Lydia, my youngest sister, I guess she just eloped with her boyfriend. And also? Wow." Rapidly, Liz typed, "For real? Not a joke?" Mary hadn't yet responded when Liz sent an additional text, 4 question marks. Ham being transgender. It seemed impossible. And Lydia had known? But, Liz thought, he had a goatee. A few seconds later, Mary's response appeared. "Not a joke." Shortly, there followed, "And Lydia always accused me of being gay." And then, "Dad and Kitty driving to Chicago now. Mom losing her shit. When can you get here?" Liz looked at Darcy, who had parked, turned off the ignition, and was watching her with concern. "Sorry," Liz said. I didn't see this coming. I should talk to Mary. Do you want to get a table and I'll meet you inside?" Darcy passed her the keys. And as he climbed from the car, Liz was already calling her sister. "You're sure that Ham is transgender?" Liz said when Mary answered. "And you're sure they eloped? This isn't some prank Lydia's pulling?" "They, Ham, came out to Mom and Dad last night, and it didn't go well. This morning, there was a note on the kitchen table from Lydia saying they're getting married."
"Does he have a fake penis?"
Later, Liz would be relieved that it was only Mary to whom she'd posed this prurient question. "How should I know?" Mary said.
but Mom is acting crazy. I can't deal with her.
What are Dad and Kitty planning to do in Chicago? Do they think they can stop the marriage?
Lydia and Ham can't do it today because courthouses are closed on Sunday. Then tomorrow is Labor Day. Plus, I checked online and they'll have to wait a day to use their marriage license. Unless they already had one before they left, which I doubt. Basically, I don't see how they can make it official until Wednesday at the earliest.
I'm not in New York, Liz said. I'm in California. Are you at your apartment or the house?
The house. And Mom just popped a bunch of Valium that I think expired 10 years ago.
Hold on.
Liz lowered her phone and began typing, searching for flights to Cincinnati. The earliest option she could plausibly make left San Francisco at 11:40 a.m., entailed a layover in Atlanta, and would deliver her to Cincinnati at 9:28 p.m. The cost of this decidedly indirect journey would be $887, which she was pretty sure would deplete the last of her once respectable-seeming savings.
I'll go to the airport as soon as I can and text you from there, Liz said.
It's so typical of Lydia to make us deal with her shit.
I like Ham, though, Liz said. Don't you?
I don't care about Ham, Mary said. I have a paper due next week.
Chapter 130. Inside the creamery, Liz spotted Darcy in a booth. A large plastic menu lay open in front of him. And again, she was gripped by an awareness of the parallel universe in which they could function as an ordinary couple. This only made it more difficult to say as she approached the table.
I'm so sorry, but I need to go.
I'm sorry to ask this. Could you take me back to Charlotte's to get my stuff, then give me a ride to the airport?
What's wrong?
The person Lydia eloped with, her boyfriend, he's transgender. I guess my parents are really upset. Darcy didn't seem shocked. And Liz was reminded of his general disapproval of her family. That the Bennets would find themselves in further turmoil appeared to be no more or less than he expected.
He said,
"You want me to take you to the airport now?"
I just think, it sounds like I'm needed at home.
Why?
It was a surprisingly difficult question to answer. Haltingly, Liz said,
"This isn't the kind of news my parents will respond to well, especially my mom."
"Isn't that their problem? It doesn't seem like Lydia or her boyfriend did anything wrong."
Darcy's abruptly condescending tone reminded Liz of when they'd first met. "Do I think my parents will figure out a way to deal with this if I'm not there?" Liz said.
"Of course."
She could hear her voice turn wobbly as she said, "But you know what? I didn't really involve myself with stuff at home for 20 years, and during that time, a lot of things went off the rails."
"You think getting on a plane will retroactively assuage your guilt?"
"I'm not trying to convince you I'm right," Liz said. "I just want to know if you'll take me to the airport or if I should call a cab."
Darcy shut his menu.
"Fine."
But in the same gesture with which he agreed to help her, some goodwill between them officially dissolved. Their ST was no longer a fireball threatening to engulf Northern California.
"You won't be dining with us today?"
a waiter said as they walked toward the front of the restaurant, and Darcy said brusquely,
"No."
"Another time," Liz added with fake brightness.
Back in the car, Darcy was quiet, and so was she. It occurred to her to ask him to simply go straight to the airport, and to have Charlotte send on her belongings, except that Liz didn't wish to risk separation from the digital recorders she'd used to interview Kathy DeBerg. She hadn't realized she'd been rehearsing concise explanations of the situation to offer Charlotte and Cousin Willie until she entered the house and found their bedroom door still closed. Liz stuffed her clothes and toiletries into her suitcase and her digital recorders and notebook into her purse
and was wondering if she should at least leave a note for her hosts when, passing again by their closed door, she heard female gasps that were unmistakably sexual in nature. She hurried out. Darcy had never turned off the engine, and after her suitcase was stowed in the back seat, even before she'd fastened her seat belt, he began driving again. After a prolonged silence, she said, "If you'd told me Lydia had eloped with a cowboy she'd just met in a bar, or with the Bengals quarterback, sure. But this? I don't know. I've never seen her as having a lot of sympathy for people outside the mainstream." Darcy said nothing. "I wonder if my mom even knows what transgender means," Liz added. "I guess she does now." Perhaps 10 more minutes passed in silence, and Liz said, "Ham's on the short side for a guy, but I never would have guessed. He has a goatee, and he's very muscular."
"I'm sure he's on a testosterone regimen."
Darcy spoke curtly. "Have you ever had transgender patients?"
"Yes, but not because they were transgender. For that, they'd see an endocrinologist."
The traffic on the 101 was light. It was still just 8:30 on the Sunday morning of Labor Day weekend, and Darcy drove in a middle lane. Despite the urgency she felt, sadness billowed in Liz at the first sign for the airport. She could hear the uncertainty in her own voice as she said, "I'm not sure how long I'll be in Cincinnati, but when do you get back?"
"Tuesday morning, but I go straight to work."
"Well, depending on how long I'm in town, maybe I can make this up to you." Again, he said nothing. And when he pulled up in front of the terminal, she said, "Don't get out. It's faster if I just grab my stuff." He complied. And after she'd retrieved her suitcase from the back seat, she waved. "Thank you, Darcy." She'd been afraid he wouldn't get out anyway, that he wouldn't try to hug or kiss her. And that was why she'd told him to stay seated, because she hadn't wanted his non-embrace to be the last thing that happened before she boarded a cross-country flight. Chapter 131. Mr. Bennett had found the note from Lydia upon entering the kitchen of the Tudor that morning. "By the time you read this, Ham and I will be on our way to Chicago to get married. Don't try calling because we're not taking our phones. If you make me choose between you and Ham, I pick Ham. From Lydia, the bride." As had occurred to Liz, neither Mr. nor Mrs. Bennett had been familiar with the term transgender before the previous evening, and having it jointly defined by Lydia and Ham over cocktails in the living room had not brought forth the best in them. Why, as Mrs. Bennett told Liz upon her arrival home, she had never heard of such a thing. How strange and disgusting that Ham was really a woman, and what could Lydia be thinking to get involved with someone so obviously unbalanced? Though Mr. Bennett had received the news with slightly greater equanimity, he had hardly been a paragon of respect, saying cheerfully to Ham,
"If only you'd been born a century ago, you could have been one of Barnum's bearded ladies."
Lydia and Ham hadn't, during that conversation, been seeking Mr. and Mrs. Bennett's approval for their marriage. Indeed, there had been no discussion of marriage. Their decision to elope, Mary explained to Liz, seemed to have arisen in reaction to the lack of acceptance or grace with which Mr. and Mrs. Bennett had greeted Ham's disclosure. Also, prior to Liz's return home, Mrs. Bennett had called their longtime lawyer and friend, Landon Reynolds, who'd explained that turning to the police would serve no purpose. Eloping wasn't a violation of the law, and there was nothing to suggest that Ham had taken Lydia to Chicago against her will. While the illegality of same-sex marriage in both Ohio and Illinois could potentially render Lydia and Ham's union void were Ham deemed female, seeking an annulment on Lydia's behalf, given that she was well over the age of consent, would be complicated and costly. And, in any case, it seemed likely that the gender listed on Ham's driver's license, if not his birth certificate, was male. His best advice, Mr. Reynolds told Mrs. Bennett, was to buy a bottle of champagne and wait for the newlyweds to return. Yet, so insistent was Mrs. Bennett that 20 minutes later, at her urging, Kitty and Mr. Bennett had begun the almost 5-hour drive to Chicago with what Mrs. Bennett chose to believe was the goal of either preventing the couple's nuptials, or, if it was too late, of separating them and transporting Lydia back to Cincinnati alone. Mary, in the meantime, had been tasked with calling Chicago hotels to check for reservations under Bennett or Ryan, a search that by late Sunday night remained fruitless. Shortly after Mr. Bennett and Kitty's departure, Mrs. Bennett had swallowed the expired Valium and retired to bed. And this was where, at 10:30 p.m., Liz found her. The older woman was weeping with a vigor that appeared unsustainable. Yet the voluminous scattering of tissues across the bed, nightstand, and nearby rug suggested that she had been at it for some time. Indeed, of the 4 tissue boxes sitting atop the mattress, 2 were empty, 1 was half empty, and 1 was as yet unopened but clearly waiting to be deployed. Mrs. Bennett herself was surrounded by flotsam that included a cordless phone, 2 remote controls. When Liz entered the room, the television was showing an infomercial for a spray-on sealant, a partially consumed 3-ounce chocolate bar, a king-size package of Cheetos reduced to orange crumbs, and a preponderance of throw pillows. On the nightstand were a low-ball glass and a bottle of gin. Mary, who had opened the front door of the Tudor and led Liz to their mother's lair, now stood just inside the room with her arms folded. Liz approached the bed and sat, setting her hand on her mother's arm. "Hi, Mom." Mrs. Bennett shook her head, her cheeks florid and damp. "She's so pretty," she said in a mournful voice. "I don't know why a pretty girl would go and do such a terrible thing." "I really think him is a good person," Liz said. "Remember how he helped me clean out our basement?" "Are there people like this in New York?" "There are transgender people everywhere," Liz said. "And there have been throughout history." Both in the San Francisco airport and then on her layover in Atlanta, Liz had, via her smartphone, learned about the Katoyi in Southeast Asia and the Salzikrum of the ancient Middle East. Also, she now knew to refer to it as a gender reassignment rather than a sex change. She knew that Ham might well not have had bottom surgery. Based on her own observations, she strongly suspected he'd had top. And, in any case, she knew to be embarrassed for having asked Mary if Ham had a fake penis. It was apparently no less rude to speculate about the genitals of a transgender person than about those of a person who was non-transgender or cisgender. As far as she was aware, Liz had, prior to meeting Ham, regularly interacted with only 1 transgender person, a 60-something woman who was a copy editor at the magazine where Liz and Jasper had been fact-checkers. Surely, if Liz had learned that anybody in her social circle in New York had eloped with someone transgender, she'd have greeted the news with support. She might even have felt that self-congratulatory pride that heterosexual white people are known to experience due to proximate diversity. So why, she decided, should her feelings be any different for Ham? Especially now that she understood and could disregard the slight evasiveness he'd shown the time Liz had asked about his upbringing in Seattle, or Kitty's taunting implication that Liz was ignorant of Ham's true character. Which she didn't believe she had been, Liz thought. In the air over the wheat fields of Kansas, Liz had concluded that if a Cincinnatian could reinvent herself as a New Yorker, If a child who kept the diary and liked to read could ultimately declare that she was a professional writer, then why was gender not also mutable and elective? The enduring mystery of him, really, was how he managed to stand Lydia's company, and how he now planned to do so for a lifetime.
"Five of you,"
Mrs. Bennet said, and a fresh wave of tears released themselves.
"How is it there are five of you and not one can find a nice, normal, rich man to settle down with?"
"Mom, we're healthy," Liz said. "We aren't drug addicts. Things could be so much worse. And with Dad having been in the hospital, doesn't it put something like this in perspective?"
"Does Ham get up in the morning and say, 'Today I'll wear a dress. No, trousers. No, a dress.'"
"I'm pretty sure he's a guy all the time, Mom. Just think of him like you did before you knew he used to be female."
Used to be female. Liz had a hunch such a phrase ought not to be uttered by her newly enlightened self, though she'd check online.
"Mom, you should go to sleep," Mary said.
"I'm waiting to hear from your father,"
Mrs. Bennet said, and Mary said, "He and Kitty are probably going to sleep now, too." Mrs. Bennet glared between her daughters.
"How selfish you all are," she said,
"doing
what you like without regard to how it reflects on our family name."
"Okay, I'm done here," Mary said, and Liz stood, too.
"Mary's right, Mom," Liz said. "You should sleep."
Chapter 132.